And that was J.B. Fuselier and a song that he calls The Roundup Hop. Welcome to Encore. This week is the second part of the interviews from the In Your Own Backyard series that CSET puts on the second Tuesday of every month. And it is about the Evangeline Baseball League that we had here in Louisiana. And the interview was done with Dr. Paul Leslie from Nicholls State and Terry Fox and Gene Bakke, who were both former professional baseball players. And Gene Bakke did play. He was one of the lucky players who got to play in the Japan Baseball League. We're going to start off with an interview. If you listened last week, Terry Fox asked a question to the audience. Why is the distance between second and third base longer than the distance between first and second? And he didn't give the answer last week, so it's in this first interview. And after this, we're going to listen to a little bit of the a little story about the Japan baseball and some history from a local baseball lover who grew up with the Evangeline League.
About, I'm still thinking about longer from second to third than from first to second. Pardon me? No, sir. I've only had one person know the answer. I'm running that from, I'm talking about necessarily running or anything. I'm saying that from second base to third base is longer than from first base to second base. There's a shortstop in between.
Man alive.
Good one?
That's what you had me.
That's good. That's good. That's what you learn in the big leagues.
We don't just chew the back and spit in the bullpen, understand? We tell stories.
Wait, one more thing. Yes. When they were talking about the computers, there's an organization you probably all heard of, Bill James, who worked with Boston and who was one of the people who was instrumental for Moneyball. For every home run that's ever been hit, basically, the Society of American Baseball Researchers is called SABR. You can Google it, and you'll find enough mathematical formulas to last you until the end of time. But they have recorded every home run, where it was hit, and they also have where the wind was blowing and the temperature that day when the ball was hit. Wherever possible. So, I mean, those are things that have gotten into the game because of mathematics and, like you said, the desire to win.
Excuse me. Go ahead, sir. No, sir, but we became friends. When I played in Chicago, I'm from Chicago, of course, I would watch him play. Chicago was our team. Chicago White Sox. The Cubs were the foreign team up north, see, of Chicago.
All right. I'm going to cut in real quick. We've got two door prizes to give away, and I have two assistants here to help me.
When we went to Japan in 62 that winter, there was two ball players that were there from Sacramento. I'm trying to think quick, like the pitcher from Oklahoma that jumped the White Sox and went over there.
Joe Stanka.
Joe Stanka and the little shortstop infielder. They called him the White Mouse over there. He said they always did things different. that he was on third base and they hit the fly ball and they tell him, I'm going to catch up, but you run. You got to score. He said, but they might throw me out. Well, no, he says, they might miss too. He says, just run. So he went and he ran the next time and they tagged him out. They said, oh, tough luck. You see, so they always did things different in Japan. They throw the ball back to the pitcher from the first baseman, not the third baseman like they do in the States.
And I know they did a lot more spring training. We didn't.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
We'd get up at 7 in the morning to go to in spring training now. We'd run along the beach for about an hour, and we'd go back in, have breakfast, and then back on the field. And then from about 9, it was like a 9 to 5 job. From 9 to 5, you played ball.
Yeah.
And try to keep busy for 8 hours playing ball. It was tough. The two guys I met when I first got to Japan, the two first Americans, I'm walking down there and I see this tall guy. I said, my God, who is that? And he says, when he saw me, he says, oh, he says, you're one of the new ones. I said, yeah. I says, what's your name? He says, I'm Don Newcomb, and that's Larry Doby. I didn't know him.
Yeah. Oh, sir, we have a question over here. I just want to remind everybody, I have a microphone. I'll come around and get it. I'm sorry.
That's all right. No, is he going to ask a question?
My name is Jim Delahousie. I was born in New Iberia in 1938. And I came here tonight because I wanted to hear some people talking about things that are very nostalgic for me, and that was the Evangelin League. From about 1946 to 1952, can you hear me?
I'm listening now.
Can you hear me? Okay. The baseball games that were played in the New Iberia Pelicans Park in were probably the most important things that happened in New Iberia. And it created heroes for us. There was no television, and the only live entertainment we had was those baseball games in that so-called stadium. As kids, we kind of divided our time when we went to a ball game to learning about the game and trying to see up the girls' dresses in the open bleachers. So we learned important things about both of those at that time. The player that stands out most in my mind was a hero that we had at that time who was also a center fielder and a pitcher. He was about 6.5 feet tall, we thought, and his name was Remy LeBlanc.
I remember him.
Y'all remember him?
Yeah, Remy LeBlanc. Yeah.
Well, he was the big dude for us at that time. I mean, he could hit home runs. When the game got in trouble, they would bring him in from center field to pitch. And he could throw a very fast ball, which I imagine then was about 89 miles an hour. But he could get people out because they couldn't hit his fastball. The problem is he couldn't get his fastball over the plate very often. So anyway, thank you both for coming tonight and reminding some of us of a very important time in our lives when we were kids. And the things we experienced probably provided us some background for the way we live today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank
but
you
Remy, Remy LeBlanc played with me the 2 years I played in New Iberia. And he, to my opinion, I only seen one other outfielder, Al Heist in Sacramento, that could cover the ground that Remy covered. But as far as batting, he always had numerous different stances because he wasn't hitting well. But I can remember the year before I came here, he was supposed to have gone to Houston to play. And in turn, the team was on the road, and he sat there for a couple of days, and he wasn't waiting anymore, so he decided to come back to New Iberia. He was a New Iberia boy, and that's where he wanted to play. But he was a great ball player. Oh, yeah.
Gene Terry, Herbert Schilling here.
Yes,
my father
sir.
Came down here to play baseball in the 20s and formed the Evangelin League. He was a manager of the Lafayette White Sox. And we have a picture here of the team back in 1934 when they played. But very few people here, other than my friend here, Judge Cully Saloon, was there in 1934 when the league started. So I'd like Judge Saloon to share a few stories of the first years of the Evangelin League. Judge?
Judge? crowley. Say poor my jolly this way. Alla les yeux sing a night. Alla les feux si boucle comme un champion malheureux. Ça pas bien les malheureux de partisans, de faire tout ça de mauvais. Moi, je m'en vais dans le chemin comme un pauvre orphelin. Yeah, man. De promener. Malheureux, moi je peux pas t'oublier. Tu la portes en avant, moi je connais, tu veux pas rentrer. Quand tu la connais, mais tu veux pas rentrer. Quand tu la connais, mais tu veux pas rentrer. Quand j'ai un cadenas sur la porte en arrière, moi je connais, tu veux pas rentrer. Monster chain, you keep a part on three. Monster chain, you keep a part on three. Et la canne sur la porte du côté, moi je connais, tu peux pas rentrer, yeah. On dit là, tu peux pas rentrer. On dit là, Dirty, 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 dirty
And that was Cliff Bro and Cleoma Bro Falcon with two songs. First one was called Pourquoi Tim Kit, and the second one was called Continue a Sonne. And before that, we were listening to some of the interviews from the In Your Own Backyard series. These interviews were taken from the In Your Own Backyard in May. And it's about the Evangeline Baseball League. And this is part two of the interviews that I pulled from that night. As we were finishing up that second interview, the recording of the second interview, a gentleman was introducing Mr. Saloon, Judge Saloon, and we are going to listen to the history that he knows about Lafayette and the baseball fields, and he'll introduce himself. But he talks about Lafayette and the baseball and where the fields were, and it's really interesting. So I hope you enjoy it, Judge Saloon.
In the early days, of course, was a part of a semi-pro type unorganized league. Eventually, the Evangeline League was formed, and the Hot Sauce League. We know for sure that it was probably the leading Class D league in the country. I hope there's no short from me. Mr. Herbert Schillings, Mr. Morgan Rodemaker, and my uncle, Frem Bustani, were the co-owners of the Lafayette White Sox. The White Sox Park was called Parkdale. It was located on Simcoe Street across from what we now know as the Louisiana Motors. And that was the ballpark. It belonged to the land, and the turf belonged to Dr. F.E. Girard. I remember this because I was in high school in those days, and from time to time I'd earn $1 to be the scorekeeper. It was very interesting. I wrote the articles as a young high school student, and I'd bring them to the Daily Advertiser. And Mr. Tom Callahan, a good old Irishman of those days, said, "Young man, we don't pay for these articles," he says, "but we will give you a byline." I said, "A byline? Exactly what's a byline?" He explained it to me. I said, "Well, I'm glad to know it. I can always eat at home if you don't pay." And that was the reason. Francis Gishro was one of the early writers of the Evangeline League, and if you go to the archives, you will find that he wrote many of the stories. And he guided me as a young kid. He was older than I, and he helped when he couldn't attend. He would call on me to go over. Many successful businessmen later were little kids like I was at the time, and we appreciated baseball. It was the great entertainment of Lafayette. We had the movie houses, but that was it. And if you were rich enough, you could play golf. But most of us went to the baseball field, Parkdale, and we had great time. You know, Lafayette was small in those days. The big city of our area, the biggest in the South, was New Orleans. Their baseball team was the New Orleans Pelicans. They were in the Southern League. They were a branch of the Cleveland Indians. And on one occasion, they won the Dixie Series in a very tight battle with the Houston Buffaloes. On the way back from Houston, we prevailed on them to get a stop in Lafayette and play the Lafayette White Sox. And we had a 32 or 33-year-old pitcher called T. Paul LeBlanc. He pitched 9 innings, and we completely shut him out. We beat the Dixie champions 1-0. That was the great, great glory day of Lafayette baseball. Of course, UL, the college here had baseball teams. Most of it is about the baseball field was in a different area. It was closer, I imagine, to what you'd call the Hyman's residence, the old Hyman residence in that particular area. But the main baseball park of Lafayette was, as I indicated a moment ago, across the street on Simcoe Avenue near the golf course. I can tell this to Herbert, I had a connection with his daddy because I played second base, but he was my hero. He was a great second baseman. Herbert's daddy was a great hitter. Of course, his uncle was a first baseman. And the excitement of Lafayette when we brought a great Canadian League player to Lafayette to play first base. We had maybe 600 to 1,000 fans at the old Parkdale Stadium. Lafayette has been a great source, and Acadiana has been a great source of baseball. We've come a long way, of course. World War II made a lot of changes. Baseball has not survived as much in the professional ranks, but our university here and our high schools here have pretty good teams in the surrounding area. And that's about my story, and that's what I remember. I left Lafayette, as I said, in 1939 and didn't return till 46. I played second base, and they still remember me in Africa. When I first got up, I was the last fella to be chosen because they said, you're too small. But what can you play? I said, I can play second base. Says, we got a second baseman. I said, I'll play shortstop. Well, I was number 9 hitter. I was 9 on the list. But after a few games, I became the cleanup hitter. Not the fourth, but the third. Rather the third hitter, because I could single or walk. And then they found out I was too small to hit them real far, so they put me the first man up, and I'd always get a walk, and I could run fast, too. That's my baseball history.
You mentioned one thing also. You're talking about great players here from Lafayette. J.B. Richard, he'd pitch double headers in the Evangeline League, but he never wanted to leave Lafayette. For some reason, I don't know why, but he was one of the best pitchers that was in the Evangeline League when I played. And
at Boudin and Crawford, boy, I'll get you.
Well, maybe they were paying him more.
Yeah.
Well, you have to remember back in 1947, the average salary for a baseball player in the major leagues was about $5,000. There were people on the Houma Indians in 1946 that made about that. In fact, they were able to negotiate for bonuses. They had one player who pitched over here in Lafayette in 52. Who got banned from baseball for a couple of years by the name of Bill Thomas. But Bill Thomas had a rubber arm. He probably threw spitters and everything else. In fact, you always had two chances to hit him when you were at the plate. But he had such control. But in 1946, he won 30 games and lost a couple. And he had also negotiated with meat company that owned his contract that if he won 30 games that his wife would get a mink coat, and he was determined that she got that coat. So, this is one of the things that up to 1946 the league was a very honorable league as far as the players. But after 1946, you get a couple of bad years when you have Houma and Abbeville that have some players who all of a sudden hit the wall of not going up. And when you have World War II veterans coming back and players and a lot of these players got pushed down. And so in 46, and in particular, some of the players who played baseball wanted to make one big killing before they left, and so they began to bet on baseball. And there was a New Iberia player that Terry, I know Terry knows, by the name of Bill McCullough, that we interviewed along with Moon Mullins one day, who was the commissioner of the league in the 1950s. And Bill McCullough maintained that the Houma Indians in 1946, I mean, who had probably one of the best teams that ever played in the Evangeline League, actually had run the league because there were four players on that team that got banned from baseball. A couple of them came back, but others didn't even care that much about it, and because they were betting on the games, and they actually, I don't know if you could. It's in between Joe Powers from Opelousas. It's not so much they threw the game as they pitched a pitcher against Alexandria, who had never beaten Alexandria. And they knew that he couldn't beat Alexandra. And so the manager got into it and scheduled him in the first game. And they knew that that they would win, they would lose the game. And so the players on the Houma Indians actually bet against their own team.
Thank you.
Was Hackberry Ramblers with something called My Shared Bell. And before that, the Dixie Ramblers, who had a lot of the same players as the Hackberry Ramblers at one point, played Dixie's Hottest, also known as High Society. And before we heard those two tracks, we were listening to some history from Judge Saloom, and he was talking about the Evangeline League that was here in Lafayette. And that little piece of interview was taken from some interviews done at the In Your Own Backyard series the second Tuesday of May at Vermilionville. And the Center for Cultural and Ecotourism puts on these In Your Own Backyard series every second Tuesday of the month. They always have really interesting topics, and I wish I could make it to more of them more often, but I really enjoy getting to go through these interviews. So I hope you get to, if you're free on a Tuesday night, I think they start around 6 or 6:30, go out to Vermilionville and check out these interviews that they have. We're going to listen to some more of those interviews, and then we'll get back to some more music.
Too many mistakes, except I met this guy. But other than that, it was fantastic.
Quick, like, I couldn't get away from him. In 61 with Detroit, we were in first place most of the year. The Yankees were right there with us all the time. We go into Yankee Stadium. I think we lost 2 out of 3. We left Yankee Stadium. I think we were a game and a half behind. And then we lost 8 out of 11. We ended up winning 101 ball games that year and came in second. But we were invited to go to Japan then the next winter. I can't get rid of them. Who do I meet over there?
That was in 62.
That's right.
No, 63. 62.
Well, the winter of 62.
The winter, yeah, that's right.
Gene's over there, and everybody in the world knows him over there. You understand? Can't do no wrong. That's what
and
I
I'll
said.
Never forget the general manager, Jim Campbell. Yeah. When he saw me in the hotel lobby, he said, what are you doing here over here? So you're in the service? I said, I'm playing ball. I said, thank you. Thank you for giving my release.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Well, we all look to be in sports and to do something good. And in my case, quick like, I had a chance to be in the Hall of Fame twice. Of course, once it was for Roger Maris's home run. See? And I didn't think that would look too good. But then we're playing the Yankees again. And I come in relief and I pitch 8 2/3 innings in relief, shutout ball.
Cool.
It's 22 innings were played. The longest game time-wise, 7 hours. I got in trouble. Phil Reagan came in and got the batter out to finish my inning off. We didn't score. He went out to hit a home run, and we lost the game. Eventually, I believe the Giants broke it. But 7 hours on a Saturday afternoon, Yogi Berra caught the whole game for the Yankees. We played doubleheaders at that time. The next day, Sunday, in Detroit, we're playing a doubleheader. Yogi catches both games. You didn't let anybody take your spot if you could, because there was always somebody better than you, but it seemed like. And if they got a chance, they would prove it. At the end of my career, I was with Philadelphia. We had one of the oldest teams at that time. Bill White was at first base. Harvey Keen was supposedly a left fielder. He played infield most of the time. We had Dick Groat. We had Johnny Callison. We had, I can't think of them quick like. He had a problem with drugs a little bit. But he hit the longest home run, Richie Allen, out of Philadelphia Stadium. I had come in to pitch. I was in the clubhouse. He come in and chug-a-lug the beer. He's, don't worry about it, Foxy's, I'm going to hit you one. And he hit it out of the park, the longest home run that I've ever seen. But it was, no matter where you went, there was always good camaraderie. It's the managers that always had a problem. Dick Groat, say, was sometimes injured and all that. But Charlie Dressen, again, when he came to Detroit, you see, he never forgot that I didn't throw a curveball. So it wasn't long, like I said, I was gone. But they always want to dominate. When I went up with Milwaukee, the manager wanted the pitchers to be able to know what the count was on every hitter. And I don't know if you ever had this experience. If it was 2-2, that would equal 4. And if I only had 3 pitches, that means the 4th pitch would revert back to the fastball. And then whatever the catcher put down, how many pumps, you had to add that and then make sure that you knew, or he knew, that you only had 3 pitches and not 4. So every pitcher that went out there to pitch, that catcher had to know what everyone threw. And I think that's why they thought Del Crandall was so good, you see, because he could count real good, I guess. But Charlie Lau, which was the second string catcher, the bullpen was out in right center. And it was just a little shack out there with a roof on it and a little cover here in the front. You couldn't see what was down there. Well, Charlie Lau would sit down on the floor there, and they had a little hole, and he had binoculars. By the end of the first inning, he was calling the pitches for the Milwaukee batters. So you couldn't sit but one person in that little shed out there, because if you moved your head one way or the other, it was a breaking pitch. But if you looked straight ahead, it was a fastball. So Charlie would tell them what was coming, and the batters could see out there in the bullpen. And, of course, not all hitters wanted to have that known to them. Joe Adcock from Cachado over here didn't like to have the count or know what pitch was coming, because he said he didn't hit as well. But yet, everybody tried to find a way how to win. We had Mario Cardenas, which was a pitcher here in New Iberia when I was here the second year. He won 18 ball games. I played 2 winners in Mexico, with Mexico City. We played against Mario Cardenas. I watched him pitch all year. There in Mexico, he was giving his pitches away. The Mexican players on our team were calling the pitches. He came here, it was a fastball. If he went over his head, it was a curveball with the ball. And you say that there's every, that no matter what you did in sports, they watch you, they take pictures of you. They want to make sure that they can see something that you're doing wrong. And my little thing, in order to get a curveball from a fastball grip, was I would spin the ball, but I had to bend my wrist behind me as I went into my motion. If not, I just went straight It was that little hitch in my wrist. We're in Boston. I come in to pitch. I'm pitching, and all of a sudden I hear the third base coach whistling every time I'm throwing a curveball. And I'm wondering, what in the heck am I doing? The next day I'm in the bullpen. We play it again. So I'm going through everything I'm doing, and I find out that, yeah, I had a hitch in my delivery. So I had to go to a no windup right away. And I'm in the game again. No matter what they look for, everybody wants to win. But you always say, well, we play the hardest you can, but you enjoy the game. We played with the greatest players, K-Line, Calavito. Gene was K-Line. The same line.
K-Line.
That's right. Milwaukee had some of the more prominent players, too. Aaron, Warren Spahn, Matthews. Burdett had a trick play all the time. When he'd wipe his bill, he had a crack in his teeth, and he could spit in his hand and catch it and throw the spitter. Very secretive, you see. No matter who pitched, you say, well, how can I get him out? You see, the catcher don't know what he's calling. I got to think of something better. So there was always somebody that looked like they were throwing spitters or doing something. And until you get caught, well, that was part of life, I guess.
Yeah.
little something by the Hackberry Ramblers that they like to call C'est pas la peine. And before that, we heard Old My Josephine by the Hackberry Ramblers as well. And we have about 2 minutes and 18 seconds left of interviews. So we're going to go out with that and a couple more songs. Two songs by Leo Swallow. We're going to go with The Blues Support Arthur and Quand Je Suis Bleu. But before that, like I said, we're going to listen to the little bit of interview that we have left. I'd like to thank you all for joining me for this part two of these interviews about the Evangeline League. Again, they are with Dr. Paul Leslie, Terry Fox, and Jean Bakke. And Dr. Leslie is a historian at Nichols, and Terry Fox and Jean Bakke are both former professional baseball players. Also, we heard two segments of interview from Judge Saloom as well about the history that he knows of Lafayette and the baseball fields and the baseball league and growing up with the Evangeline League and what that meant to him. So thank you again for joining me here for Encore. Encore airs every Sunday at 7 a.m. and every Saturday at 7 a.m. and Sunday at 3 p.m. If you'd like to get a repeat, if you'd like to hear this episode again or any other locally produced episode, you can go to krvs.org and download our podcasts. All right, we're going to go out with this last bit of interview and a couple songs by Leo Swallow. Have a great rest of the weekend, and I'll see you next week.
I went to Atlanta, Crackers, the second year, which was 58. Clyde King was the manager. He was a pitcher. He eventually was manager for the Yankees to fill in when they got fired. And they had two bonus babies that they brought out to the mound. He said, none of your other pitchers can come out here. Stay in the dugout. And I'm thinking, what is so important that you and you can go out there and I can't? What is it that you're going to tell them that nobody else should know? Well, he's going to show them a pickoff move. So I'm standing on the foul line. I said, I'm not out there on the grass, but I'm right here. I'm a watch. So he was teaching them a pickoff move that I learned, and it got me, of course, helped me to get to the big leagues. It helped keep me in the big leagues. And eventually it became illegal. And the reason why is because that if you move your back leg on the rubber, on the mound, that means you were going to first base or you were going to step off or not throw. But if you moved your front leg, in order to throw the ball to home plate, you would have to lift your heel, push off your toe, raise your foot, and throw to home plate. But if you can raise your heel, push off your toe, and turn and throw to first base and pivot on the foot that's on the rubber when you come around, you have a chance to pick off runners. And if you stand around and talk to people, wherever you're at, and you just stand there and don't move nothing but that foot to raise the heel, and eventually everything else works in, you'll have a pretty good pickoff move. But that's the only thing that anybody has said to me about pitching in the major leagues that was beneficial. They never said anything about how to throw a pitch, other than Charlie Dressen says you better learn the screwball. But he didn't say how to throw the screwball. At that time, the coaches didn't work with the players that much. They would throw batting practice. They would coach the first and third bases. But other than that, there was not that much instructions like there is today.
my baby Jesus. Yeah.